Hello, and welcome to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. I'm Kelly Taylor. Today on the show is actor, director, producer, musician, Tim Robbins. Many know him from his roles in Shawshank Redemption, The Player, Mystic River, and currently the HBO show Here and Now. But 37 years ago, he started a theater company here in LA called The Actors Gang. And throughout his career, he's been acting, writing, and directing plays there. I talked to him about his current play called The New Colossus, about refugees and immigrants coming to America, about the work he does in California's prisons, and more. He didn't have a lot of time, so it's a quickie. Enjoy.
From the Fox 11 studios in Los Angeles, California, it's the Olympic and Bundy podcast with host Kelly Taylor.
So I
want to
start by saying that I really love history and learning about The New Colossus. I learned about Emma Lazarus. I really didn't know much about her, even like how the Statue of Liberty started. I mean, I knew that France gave us that, but we had to pay for the base. So they did a fundraiser of sorts, and she wrote the poem, The New Colossus, for the fundraiser to pay for it, right?
Right, right.
And then she died, and it wasn't until later that someone came across this poem, decided to put it on the plaque, and then it sort of like reinvented the meaning of the Statue of Liberty.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's quite a beautiful poem.
Yeah.
It's called The New Colossus, actually.
So can you tell me a little bit about how the play was conceptualized and when? I mean, did you stumble across the poem and have this idea, or how did it start?
Well, it started with my company of actors who are from all over the world, and in workshops on Sunday nights, I would encourage them to speak in their own languages, their first languages. And I realized I had a tremendous amount of great actors and that spoke different languages. And I thought, well, it would be really lovely to figure out something to do with them. And one Sunday we were workshopping. It was about 3 years ago. The Syrian crisis was happening, and the part of the workshop was just to ask the question, what is a refugee? What defines what a refugee is? And when we started to examine it, we realized that a lot of our ancestors would have been considered refugees, people that traveled anywhere from the 17th century to now, leaving behind a country or a town that was for them unlivable, not because they wanted to go somewhere else, but because they couldn't live where they were living. And so this challenge of survival became a story for us. And so I asked the actors to tell the stories of their ancestors' journey from oppression to freedom. And so they all wrote their own ancestors' stories, and they're performing them on stage at the Actors Gang.
And then it all came together one day. And so there's 12 different stories, right?
Yeah.
And they are all speaking that language. There's 12 different languages that are spoken at some point.
Yes. There's 12 different languages spoken. There is English spoken. There are translations at times on super titles. It's really interesting. We did it when we were doing it in workshop. We performed it. This was last year in the spring. We actually did a couple nights where there was no English at all, and it was really interesting to see what happened emotionally and how the story was told.
What happened?
People got it. They understood it. They didn't understand the specifics of the stories, but they got it emotionally. They realized that their journey, the difficulty of everyone's journey that is telling their story in this play, reflects on their own journey and their own family's journey.
Yeah. I was reading somewhere, do you still have, at the end of the play, talk to the audience and, you know, see if there's any people in the audience who were refugees or their families were refugees and have them share that story?
Yes. And we've had amazing stories told after the show. People standing up and testifying about their grandparents or their great-grandparents, or some of them even refugees themselves, telling their story of how they got here. It's really moving.
Out of curiosity, have you learned more about your own ancestry?
Well, I pretty much knew it. My grandfather in his 50s and 60s, did a lot of research into our own family history and wrote a history. So the first Robbins that we're aware of was John Robbins, who was in Massachusetts in 1660. Oh, yeah, pretty far back.
Yeah.
And tracing the journeys of my family, they came, my mother's side came through the South and into Missouri, and my father's side through Massachusetts and then out west to Washington State. And my parents met in UCLA.
They went to UCLA as well?
In the marching band.
Wow. You have a lot of Bruins in your family.
I do.
Your family's so creative.
You know what else, though? I had to pay tuition for 4 years to USC for my son, so it was a difficult thing to do being a Bruin.
Wait, so he...
He went to USC Film School. I had to pay the tuition.
Were you a little bit upset?
Maybe a little
in
upset.
In your heart of hearts?
But he was happy, so that made me happy.
Yeah.
It was a better school than UCLA for film, so...
So as the director, and obviously being very close to this play, when people see it, what's the kind of feeling you want people to have afterwards as they leave and go into the world?
Well, what's really nice that happens with these talks after the show is we realize we are one community. Here we are, people from all over the city that have found their way to Culver City, to our theater, which is a great thing in itself that people chose to spend their time with us. But then after the show to understand that they're from all over the world, that we have the entire world in our intimate theater in Culver City. Every night, the whole world is represented. We have a map out in the lobby. When people come and get their tickets, we ask them to put up magnetic pins on this map to show where their ancestors are from. And the map at the end of the night is a beautiful thing to see because you see that we have people represented from all over the world. And at the end of the night, you realize, of course, this is what we are. This is what the United States is. This is how we were made. We were made by people that survived, that made the choice to leave an oppressive situation and seek a better life from all over the world. From so many different nationalities, so many different languages, to find a better way and to develop a community here that is a new community. And let's be honest, it was a new community to mankind when it started.
Yeah.
The idea that people from all over the world, from different cultures, could create one culture together. And that's what's beautiful about America. And that's what's so deeply upsetting and insulting to me, to hear the rhetoric that is so nationalist and racist and exclusive. It just, it doesn't have anything to do with the America that I believe in.
Yeah, it's almost, do you feel like the beacon has dimmed a little bit?
The beacon is still strong. If you're talking about the beacon in the Statue of Liberty, it's still strong. It's been dimmed a bit. I believe there's enough people in this country that hold on to this ideal. I think, unfortunately, in this country for the past 25, 30 years, there has been elements with a lot of money and influence that have sowed division in this country, found ways for us to dislike each other. And encouraged that. And I think we see the result of it now, a severely divided country. It used to be where you could go to a bar and have a drink and talk about politics and agree to disagree, but still hold up your glass to the other person and respect them for their beliefs. Now we've become so polarized and so, in a way, tribalized into these different camps and these echo chambers of hatred being expressed every day on social media, it's really concerning. It's not healthy for us as a country. And for me, what I look at and when I see that is, who is that serving? It's not serving us. We're not getting better. We're not getting wealthier or healthier. It's serving people that make money off of us being divided.
Right. Yeah. I would agree with that. When it comes to the actors' gang, I know that This is the 37th year that you've done this. You co-founded it, right? 37 years ago this year. That's crazy in itself, I think. When you find something that you can do that long, that's like obviously what you should be doing, right?
Well, it's been a great journey. It's the Actors Gang always was a place where I could go and work on something that I wanted to work on. I didn't have to ask permission for it. It was a group of like-minded individuals that worked in a real passionate and dedicated way to do real theater, not showcase theater, theater that really takes a look at the world around us and tries to create an entertainment that is not only funny or moving, but also something that asks questions, the large questions about who we are and how we relate to the lives that we live. And it's been a great experience. It's been difficult at times in, to make a nonprofit survive for 37 years.
Yeah. Oh, I can't imagine. But, and as you have, like, I mean, throughout your career, especially as you, you know, did like The Player, Bob Roberts, start to get Shawshank, start to get more success in Hollywood, and you keep going back to the Actors Gang, I imagine that that's probably been helpful in keeping you a bit sane, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's like an oasis. This, you know, let's, Hollywood is what it is. It can be great. It can be something that can feed you artistically from time to time. But let's face it, a lot of the material is not that challenging to someone that considers this as an art form. And it becomes a commercial entity too often. And that's okay. It's okay. I've participated in that element of the business. And I've made money doing that. I don't criticize anyone for doing that. I think it's a great way to make a living. And no one's really being hurt by the fact that you're making money doing it, and that's great and unique in its own way. But at the end of the day, if I want to feed my soul, I want to do stuff that's challenging, and oftentimes that those kinds of scripts, those kinds of ideas are not met with a lot of enthusiasm in Hollywood and not with a lot of budget in Hollywood. So rather than stew in unemployment and frustration because I don't want to do the scripts that they're offering me, I can go to a theater and do what I want to do creatively. And that's been a huge, huge blessing.
Yeah. You guys, your company has toured around the world, right? I mean, you guys have done plays in many different countries, continents even, right?
Five continents.
So I'm wondering if you've noticed that in different parts of the world, if theater is still regarded as a great art form in one particular area, or maybe more so here in Los Angeles, or not as much in general?
For me, it can be either a distraction or an art form. But throughout the world, what we've experienced is a real reverence for the kind of theater that we do. We sell out everywhere we go in very large venues, and that's really exciting to be able to bring our form of theater to them. In Europe in particular, it's great because we're deeply influenced by European theater. So to go to Europe and to have the incredibly positive responses we've gotten is a great affirmation. And meeting some of my theatrical heroes and seeing them see the plays that I've done and give me affirmation has been huge, a huge shot in the arm for me. Dario Fo became a mentor late in his life. He's a Nobel Prize winning Italian playwright. And I've had this experience in Roman amphitheaters performing in places that have had plays performed in them for 2,000 years. And that's a pretty extraordinary experience. We've performed in Spain, in South America, in China, getting a Chinese audience to laugh robustly at A Midsummer Night's Dream is a pretty cool thing to experience. And then we did this show called Harlequino Onto Freedom in China, which was really interesting because a play I'd written. And at the end of the play, the lead actor is arrested by the state and removed from the play, and the other actors are ordered to continue the play, to finish the play. And when they are ordered to continue the play, they start doing it, and then one actor, in defiance and in protest, puts their hands up over their head and walks off the stage. And when that person did that act of protest in the play, the entire audience clapped.
Really?
And then the second actor puts up their hands and walks off, and the audience clapped again.
The crowd goes wild.
Yeah. And they clapped for each actor that defied the state. And I was like, wow.
Wow, that's really telling.
And that's in China, yeah. Right? And yeah. So that was like, oh, my God, we just did amazing, kind of almost revolutionary act yeah. here in China.
Let's get out of here.
Let's get out of here. Get back to the hotel. Yeah. Go on, change the flights. We're going home. No, but we did get censored there, oddly enough, for a bunch of phallic jokes.
Really?
Yeah. The politics were okay, but
the phallic jokes. Penis or something?
Yeah, it was dick jokes. It was like a series of. I was very proud of this writing. About 25 dick jokes in 2 pages.
Nice.
I was very proud of that.
Yeah, okay. I like that.
Take that, Shakespeare.
Exactly.
No, he could kick my ass on that. I'm sure he would.
He could out-dick you.
Yeah.
Oh, I did want to talk to you just quickly about the prison project.
Yeah.
Do you do that year-round?
Yes.
So that's going on.
Yeah, I was there last weekend. I was in Lancaster last weekend.
So I didn't know this, but I was reading, first of all, 6 out of 10 people in California, at some point when the stat was written, returned to prison within 3 years of being released.
That's correct.
And additionally, this was in 2008, but California cut funding to arts in correctional programs.
Yes.
And if California did it, that makes me think that it's not any better anywhere else.
That's right.
Right? So was that the Kickstarter for this program? You heard about that?
No, we had already started it in 2006. So when they pulled the funding in 2008, we weren't even getting any funding from the state. So we were already just doing this as a purely volunteer program.
Gotcha.
So what we did is we went to the warden and we said, listen, we don't need anything from you guys, just the key to get in and out. Can we continue the program? And they allowed us to continue the program. So at one point we were, I believe, Marin Shakespeare and one other group up north. We were one of three arts organizations in the correctional system for about 4 or 5 years.
For all of California?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then when we started gaining some legitimacy in the Department of Corrections, when they came and observed what we did and recognized that what we were doing, in the words of the Secretary of the Department of Corrections, was cognitive therapy, and that he saw the real value in it, we started doing studies and we started expanding the program. And we had a study, and that 6 in 10 turned into 1 in 10 for the people that had been through our program.
Reoffending.
That's right.
6 in 10 down to 1 in 10.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we also had a study done that that said that there was an 89% reduction in 115s, and 115s are in-prison infractions. So for people that have been through our program. So that makes it a lot safer inside the prison as well. The 1 in 10 makes it a lot safer for all of us. And the way I view this is rehabilitation is a public safety issue. If you don't rehabilitate people that go into prison, if they don't come out with better tools to deal with disappointment and aggression than when they went in, they're going to reoffend. So why wouldn't you want to offer them programs that reduce the likelihood that they're going to commit a crime in your neighborhood, because they're coming out. You know, 99% of the people that are in prison are going to be out at some point, and they're going to be in your neighborhood. So wouldn't you want to rehabilitate them?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that prison itself is the most conducive to sharing your emotions.
And this was something that is constantly moving for us that work inside the program, is that we see these people that are shut off and angry and resistant to change really blossom, really start to be sentient human beings in front of our eyes. And they changed their lives with this thing. And that's, once we started to see that happen, we started to realize we really have to keep doing this and we really have to expand it. And so we started lobbying the state of California and were able to reinstate about 4 years ago $1 million into the state budget for our arts in corrections for rehabilitation. And then we've got it now up, I think, to over $6 million. And this is not for us. It's for arts organizations throughout the California.
Yeah. So you went from nothing. They cut it.
That's right.
And you've managed to get, in that time, $6 million back.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. And that's going to have a benefit for all of our communities, because we're through arts, and I'm totally convinced of this, arts are something that can transform. Education is great. Job training is great. AA, NA, all those are great programs. They're necessary programs, anger management, all that stuff. But what the arts can do is transform a life. It can change the way people perceive things in a fundamental way. And most importantly, can shift the way that you experience rejection or aggression. If you can process those things in a different way, in other words, if you can get your emotions right, you're going to have a lot better chance of succeeding when you get out of prison. Because you can have a job training for something, you can be trained to do a job, but if your head isn't right,
yeah, if you lose it,
yeah,
you're short fused, or you don't know how to channel that energy into
something creative.
Yeah,
same part of the brain.
Yeah. That right brain.
That's right.
We got to wrap it up? Okay. So you're about to go on the show.
Mm-hmm.
I could talk to you forever because I've also watched Here and Now. And I love that the first time you see your character, he's playing Candy Crush. In a moment of despair and depression. I relate to that. Just playing a mindless game on the phone.
Yeah, he's in a whole load of misery, yeah. That guy.
So anyways, thank you very much for coming up here.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Let's do a longer interview sometime.
Thank you for listening to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. If you made it this far, we'd love for you to hit the subscribe button in your podcast app so you can get new episodes downloaded weekly to your phone. We're on the Apple Podcast app, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, and olympicandbundy.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Olympic and Bundy. Next week is a venture capitalist and an adventure capitalist who's had health scares in his life that have led him down some interesting and rewarding paths. So look forward to that. Once again, I'm Kelly Taylor, and thanks again for listening.